From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last night when your kid could not get to sleep. All right, maybe it wasn't your kid, but it was someone's kid, maybe 11 years old, hiding a cell phone or a video game under the covers, playing a game, checking social media. Does this drive you nuts? And is it dangerous? Is it that much different than the kid or the adult, by the way, who you probably know, who can't have a dinner conversation without checking their phone multiple times? A new book aims at how families are structured and what parents can do to make sure their kid is not dominated by technology, like games, like social media, and more. The book is called The Game is Playing Your Kid, How to Unplug and Reconnect in the Digital Age. The author is Dr. Joe Dilley, the co-founder of Synergy Psychological in Los Angeles. He's in Rochester today. He gave a presentation for parents and educators this morning at the Norman Howard School, and there will be a free public screening tonight at 6 p.m. at the Norman Howard School. They're going to be screening Screenagers, Growing Up in the Digital Age, and then a panel discussion will follow that film covering the impacts of screen time for kids. Dr. Joe Dilley, author of The Game is Playing Your Kid, thanks for taking the time. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Evan. Pleased to be here.
And also here with us is someone who's talked about this issue, both in her practice and with her family, and that's Dr. Elizabeth Murray. She's an assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital. Dr. Murray, welcome back to the program.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Dr. Gorbman, Randy Gorbman is here as well.
I like the way that sounds. I just don't want to go to school to do all that work.
I just promoted you.
Can you just call me Doctor?
Dr. of News. Okay. News Director Randy Gorbman is here. Hello.
Well, hello. And actually, this is another great topic. Last hour, talking about the intersection of science and faith, now a very practical application of theory, really, talking about how kids should use their screens and what parents should do. And the kind of information that we bring you every day, not only on Connections, but on other programs you hear on WXXI, it does take some money to do all that. We do need your help. As you know, resources always are a struggle at times in public broadcasting, but we've had so many great supporters of our stations here in this community, and I hope for this pledge drive they will make their thoughts known again. You can do that by making a pledge to 454-6300. That's 454-6300. Toll free 1-800-295-9994. 1-800-295-9994. Or you can just make it online, wxxinews.org or weos.org. Whatever amount, $5, $10 more, we can use it, and we can keep bringing you this great programming that you hear with Evan Dawson on Connections every day.
Nick on Twitter says, Randy, two solid hours of programming today. Take my money, please. Well, you don't have to say please, Nick.
Right.
We'll do it.
We'll do it.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Randy. Let's have this conversation. The book is called The Game is Playing Your Kid, How to Unplug and Reconnect in the Digital Age. And there's so many places I could start, but I want to start with this. I went back to my own childhood, Joe. I thought about the fact that I was for a little while I loved the Might and Magic series of games, mm-hmm. and my mother would limit the amount of time we were allowed to play those games to, I want to say it was about an hour a day, mm-hmm. and that hour went fast. And these role playing games take a long time to win the game, man.
That's right.
But here's the thing. Eventually, there was an ending. And here's what you describe in your book. This is an idea that I had not thought about. You said, in the gaming world, developers have learned to develop games that don't end. If kids stop playing, progress is lost, their characters die, and their online friends are disappointed. And games reward them by unlocking new features, but not necessarily giving you an endpoint. So kids could essentially be playing limitlessly.
Correct.
That's different than I remember growing up.
Very different. And they can and are playing limitlessly. I had a student in my office, he's 15, about 3 weeks ago, who had been rolling around, pounding his fists on the floor, having a tantrum prior to coming to my office, not because he minds seeing me. In fact, we have a really good rapport. He does magic tricks with cards and so forth for me, and we love to meet. But what his parents explained was he wouldn't sign out of his game because he was petrified that his progress would be lost, his ranking would drop, and he endeavors to do this for a living someday. He'd love to be a professional gamer, which is kind of a cool and, you know, budding aspiration that we want to cultivate. But he became, as the title, you know, alludes, a child who was being gamed by the device. He was becoming the one being played instead of doing the playing.
Yeah, and to me, I think about, what were we playing? We were playing Zelda, Mario Brothers. Those games still exist, and there's different iterations of them. But the games that dominate all the time now are these games that are just, you know, you get involved, you have interactive, and you play, and you can I guess, Minecraft games you can play forever.
Right.
And so you're saying that the developer knows this, essentially. That they're sort of preying on this with kids, aren't they?
Sure. Yeah, and not necessarily in a malicious way, but there's something driving developers to create games this way, because as psychologists, we understand a lot about, you know, how humans respond to different sorts of stimuli and how difficult those can be to cut away from. So it's problematic when psychologists decide, hey, I'm going to use my talents to figure out how to make, a game more addictive. Now, there's nothing wrong with our, as a profession, saying, hey, I think this could be more fun or more healthy or more adaptive. But I think we cross a line ethically when we say, I know how to basically generate capital for this website or for this company by keeping kids playing and penalizing them if they don't.
Dr. Berry, what do you think of that?
It's scary but true. And I think that people forget about that, that it's not because they're playing because it's fun and I really want to do it to have a social connection. But there is something very true to what he just said, and it's something we need to kind of pause and really process.
And you think about, so for me, I the analogy I had was, in my brain, I went to food and cereals, and you know, Michael Pollan has written about how, you know, cereal makers are very good at figuring out, almost getting us addicted to food. And in my brain, I thought, well, I wonder if Joe's going to tell us that we can become addicted to screen time, addicted to games, because a lot of parents have that question. What's your conclusion? Because I know parents will ask you, can my kid actually get addicted?
It's one of the top questions that I'm asked every day. The answer is to look, rather than for a label like my kid is an addict, quote unquote, what we want to look for is a functional dependence on gaming, on social media, on tech, and figure out, again, whether your child is the one being played or the device, or whether they're the ones still in charge. And you'll know that not by virtue of what they claim or what their verbal appeal is, so much as you'll know it by their behavior and their ability to self-control, self-regulate, inhibit impulsive reactions, both in the way that they speak with you and their peers, and also how they relate to you and to their peers.
The New York Times had a piece in 2015, screen addiction is taking a toll on children. Again, are you uncomfortable with just the word flat-out addiction? Is there a difference between addiction and sort of functional dependence? I mean, how do you characterize that?
Yeah, great question. I'm not uncomfortable with the word. I just think that it can lead to sort of a red herring type of approach where we say, well, Johnny's addicted, and so what do we do with an addict? Well, we have to get him treatment. Maybe. I prefer to take a step back and look at it as we're all in a fishbowl together. And so if the water that we live in and that lives in us is polluted because we have a device at the top of the hierarchy of the family, then we need to purify the water. We all need to do something about that. Whether or not Johnny has a chemical imbalance in his brain where he's, perhaps seeking more dopamine and adrenaline and has limited melatonin to go to sleep and so forth. So addiction, maybe. Functional dependence, that'll be evidenced by how does he behave and what's it like when it's time to turn off the screen? Is he throwing a tantrum like my client a couple of weeks ago? Or is he saying, yeah, cool, I can play this later. After all, it goes on forever. That's really the crux, isn't it? That if it goes on forever, well, then they can come back to it. And if you reach number one, what does it matter? You're about to be number two in a matter of seconds or minutes or hours. Mm-hmm. And so I'm sort of surprised by how these are the games that kids and adults are reaching for. Because if it goes on forever and it's not even seasonal, then I would think that would limit some of the meaning or the implication.
That would give kids even more motivation to take a pause, but not less. Very interesting. Dr. Murray, what do you say if someone asks you, well, what about actual physical addiction when it comes to this stuff?
No, I agree, and I think this point is right on, that it certainly can exist. And the point of all of this is these devices, these platforms are never going to go away, and new ones are going to continue to pop up. We have a phenomenal school at RIT that has a degree in this type of stuff, and the games are going to come after one and after another. And so we have to figure out a way to make sure that our kids and ourselves as parents leading those kids can function in society with these games and still be productive members of society and have fun. That's okay. They are fun. We're not saying you can't have fun.
That's right.
You can have fun. It's okay. You can play these games. You can use them and still be productive members of society and have your brain grow. Nobody's saying don't do it. We just have to do it well.
Yeah, the book makes it clear that the game playing your kid is the problem. It's not the kid playing the game that is necessarily the problem. It's when there is sort of a hierarchical dominance in a child's life that says, I need this. I will throw a tantrum or worse, those kinds of things.
Exactly.
Dr. Murray, what about this question on dopamine that parents may have that, you know, you heard Joe mention this idea that, well, it's one thing to say, I want to play this game more. It's another to say, I'm concerned that, is there a dopamine release? Can kids become addicted to that? You know, is there a physiological concern there?
I could see that there could be a point of that potentially happening in the right person in the right brain. I don't think when a five-year-old says, I need this, no, they physically probably don't need it. But if you, with years of playing in an older teenager brain, I would think in that right brain, you could have some difficulties with it and have a physical response.
It's interesting you use that word. Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska has a new book out, The Vanishing American Adult. And he wrote a piece for The Wall Street Journal last week saying, it's amazing how many kids will say, I need this, and we're not teaching them well enough to distinguish between need and want. Do you agree with that, Joe?
Absolutely. Brilliant. In fact, my dad's a psychologist, and I grew up becoming interested in the field by the stories he would share at dinner about helping people. And one thing that he helped us to understand is that there is a distinction between needs and wants. And that when we get those confused, that generates tremendous anxiety because we think we're going to be prevented from obtaining this thing that we need when in fact it's something that we strongly desire but that we will not, implode if we don't have.
Talking to Dr. Joe Dilley, who is the co-founder of Synergy Psychological in Los Angeles. He's in Rochester today. He is the author of The Game is Playing Your Kid, How to Unplug and Reconnect in the Digital Age. If you want to share your thoughts on this, screen time, questions, comments, how about how you handle it, maybe in your family, with yourself, with your kids especially, 844-295-TALK. It's toll free, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Interestingly, Dr. Dilley writes that, you know, punishment doesn't really work, but rewards can. You talk about creating a rider, so tell me about this.
Sure. Okay, so punishment might work in the short term to limit problematic behavior. What it doesn't typically do is create long-term self-initiated, self-sustained change. And so if your child gets to college and is sitting down on the first Saturday of the football season and of the year and saying, you know, I've been told what to do my entire life. I've been lectured about it. I've been penalized when I do it wrong or when I do what I would like to do instead. Now I have the choice of going to the football game and tailgating, or I can stay here and study and then meet up with my friends at the game. Oh no, I'm going to tailgate and I'm going to go do that now because now it's my choice. Previously, had I done that, I would have been punished. Ah, compare that to the student who grows up understanding the difference between a double set of rewards, like I'm going to get a little studying now done now that'll pay off later, and after I study, I get to do this other thing that I really want to do. And if I don't choose to study now, well, that is my choice, but there's going to be a cost, a response cost, not a punishment, a response cost later where my grade is going to drop. And that is going to yield in turn all kinds of different things, less access to the things that I want, like privileges, less opportunities for things like scholarships and, you know, advancement in my class rank and things like that. And so rather than over-punishing and becoming kind of authoritarian, the research says, and instead of becoming permissive on the other end of the continuum, what we want to do is land in the middle and be authoritative. And that kind of parenting means kids get to drive through their own autonomy and agency the level of privilege that they can handle by virtue of their behavior. So that's where a rider, a contract, an agreement, things like that come in, where kids can say, hey, Mom and Dad, I know you're looking for this, X, Y, and Z, maybe good grades and respectful speech and socialization, extracurricular opportunities. So too, I'm looking for these kind of privileges in terms of curfews and driving and screen time and privacy. I think there's a way that we can meld these two. And kids are right when they go about it that way. The trouble is that shouldn't be on the kid to come up with that sort of solution. We, the adults, it's incumbent upon us to create that kind of space for a dialogue like that to happen, where we can help our kids to understand, I'm going to give you, as one of my mentors used to say to his own children, I'm going to give you more freedom than you know what to do with, just as soon as you show me that you can handle it. And so it becomes a commensurate level of freedom and privilege to rival the level of responsibility that's been demonstrated.
I want to hear what Dr. Murray thinks about this, but let me just follow up, because I'm getting inside the minds of our listeners who might take a harder line to say, look, Joe, I'm the parent, and I'm not going to create a rider and a contract with my kid. I'm going to tell them, these are the expectations, and you have to do these things. And you don't simply do things to get rewards. You do things because sometimes that's how this works in the house when you live under this roof. How do you feel about that?
Sure. Yeah, those are probably the parents that go to work for free, right? They don't get paid. They just enjoy the inherently rewarding nature of the job that they're doing. So that's actually the way, for better and worse, that the adult world is set up. And the trouble with the parents' approach, although well-intentioned, and man, I got to rally behind that approach from time to time myself as a parent of two, the problem is when we say you can't, you won't, you're not allowed to, the reality is they can, they do, and they're about to. And so a lot of times the very thing that we are verbally instructing them to limit, they are then sneaking around and avoiding us about so that they can do it. And by the way, it's rather ineffective when we do that from behind our own screen. You know, especially
when we're not modeling the behavior.
You got it. Yeah. Especially if we're at their soccer game, behind our own screen or behind the wheel, behind our screen. You know, to our children's credit, I think they see us pretty attached to these devices as well. I was speaking with the students at Norman Howard this morning. They get it. This is a shared shared discussion and a shared challenge for all of us.
All right, Dr. Murray, you're a parent as well, so what do you make
yes.
of this?
Oh, I love it. I love it. I think this is a great discussion. You know, yes, as parents, our primary goal is safety and health. And so those rules, of course, are going to be very different than the rules when it comes with privilege. But, you know, in the very young, we always say, catch your kid doing something right. You know, for that 3-year-old who's always getting in trouble, catch him doing something right. And you'll pretty quickly notice a change in their behavior, and then you can carry that on. You know, nobody's saying have a contract with a 3-year-old, of course. The prefrontal part of our brain, that kind of filter part of our brain, is one of the last parts to close up and develop. You know, that doesn't finish formation until you're in your 20s, more so for males than females. Sorry, it's true. So, you know, modeling that behavior and having that discussion and giving them a chance to fail is terrifying as a parent, but there's times where you need to do it because they need to learn how to recover. And I think that media use is a slippery slope in some regards, because there are definitely very real safety concerns associated with it. But on the other hand, there's ways to rein it in and monitor it where you can test the boundaries of what your child is capable of in a safe way, so that they can gain the responsibility while remaining safe and gain the confidence to make good, healthy decisions. I can't tell you how many nights as an emergency medicine physician I will see college students who have done exactly what he described, make just horrible decisions because they just didn't know how to make a better decision, whether it comes to taking 4 doses of NyQuil because the first dose didn't make their cold go away, so they thought they would just take more, to going out and partying, all those kind of things, just because all of this is so new about controlling my own life. And these are bright kids. Think about the universities and stuff we have in Rochester. These are bright kids at the schools here. So to be able to enter in that world as a citizen who can have some confidence, make some good decisions, engage in human contact, social media contact, all sorts of different platforms is just so important. And I think, yeah, catching them doing something right is a great way to frame it and start it, as long as you're maintaining safety.
No, I'm with you. Smart people can do really remarkable things and make this. I've spent an entire evening in a 911 center one time. I will not relay the kinds of calls that come in. Let me just get our first phone call. Jim in Canandaigua. Go ahead, Jim.
Hi.
Hi, Jim. Go ahead.
Hi. How are you?
Good. If you've got a radio on, turn it down and go ahead with your question.
I did turn it down. Okay.
Very good.
Can you hear me now?
I certainly can, Jim. Go ahead.
Okay. Listen, my basic question is, listen, I'm a 54-year-old man, excuse me. I have children and I have grandchildren. and I was not raised with the internet and things like that. My kids were, and my grandchildren are definitely right there, and I'm worried about my grandkids thinking that this is like a necessity of life for the Twitter and things like that. What is the difference? What do you guys think between the difference between an addiction, and like just like being like involved in this in an everyday life, and as a kid, as a little kid, how do I like just school them and talk to them and try to teach them that you don't have to do it every single moment of your time. Please.
Thank you. Go ahead, Dr. Dilley. What do you think?
Sure. Yeah, there are a few questions in there. One of them that you mentioned is, you know, how to talk to them. And I think it really does involve some give and take, some discourse about, you know, what is it that makes it difficult to sign out of social media when it's time to come have dinner face to face with one another? And maybe your child or grandchild's answers would surprise you, where maybe they're experiencing parents and grandparents at the table to be equally, if not more, disengaged or more distant than they find their online friends to be. And so it might be because they actually want to connect, and at the table maybe there's minimal discussion, or maybe it's characterized by a lot of yelling, or maybe the adults are on their devices as well. And so, you know, if I'm the kid, I think I'll stay on Instagram a while longer instead of, you know, go for the alternative. I think you were also mentioning that you didn't grow up with this kind of technology, and indeed, none of us did. It's changing every day. And so I think the next thing we need to do is not panic, because this isn't so dissimilar from any other kind of things that have threatened in the past or that still today threaten to tear families apart. And that can be even a good thing, like a really good job opportunity, but that is going to zap all of mom or dad's time and energy. Or it could be something more obviously problematic, like a drug addiction. Anytime we've got something that climbs to the top of the control tower in our house, whether that's tech or one of those other experiences or challenges that I just mentioned, that's really where we have the possibility of things getting inverted and kind of falling apart. And so we don't need to panic. We need to create an atmosphere where we can approach balance together, just like we would have for, as a teacher pointed out to me a few months ago after a presentation, just like we did in the 80s for cable TV. We had to figure out, she said, I've been teaching for a long time, and you know, you're basically saying, let's use the same approach that we did when kids were watching MTV all night. Yep, exactly.
Okay, and so let me ask you then to help define for listeners like Jim, who are trying to figure out, okay, is this kid in our family using a mobile device or playing a game or whatever it is in a way that is, I think it's maybe a lot, but it's not dominating their life. How do you determine when, you know, sort of the game is playing the kid? When is that threshold reached?
Sure. So each family is going to make that determination a little bit differently, and that's okay. This is going to be a little bit of a subjective thing for families to do. And I agree, it's all about safety first. So one, you know, telltale would be if they're using it in a way that proves to be unsafe to themselves or a peer or someone they don't know, or interacting with somebody that they don't know who's supposedly, you know, a fetching peer a couple of states away, and it turns out to be an old creeper around the corner. So safety first, and then the rest will be indicated by the child's behavior and actions and relationships. And so if everything, when they do come to the dinner table, if all discussion and all thought process still revolves around the game or the person who's not at the table physically, then yeah, it's showing up in a problematic way. Is it an addiction? I don't know. It's problematic. And so we're wise to go ahead and address it. compare that to a student who says, man, I am loving connecting with this peer that I haven't seen since the conference that we had in St. Louis. And it's so fun to be on Facebook or Instagram. I can stay up on his life and whatever. And yeah, okay, now it's time for dinner, and I'll check on what he's doing later or tomorrow. Well, that's a really healthy level of use. And you can kind of feel it in your gut. Like, you don't need to apply some sort of metric that Dr. Joe says to use. It's more of, oh yeah, that makes sense. That's ideally how we would all use everything in our lives. We're going to be talking with the students at Norman Howard this afternoon about this is how we control things like fire or matches or pancake consumption. These are all things that could get out of hand if we let them.
You can never have too many pancakes.
Well, that could be true.
But what about parents who say, look, I want my kid's Facebook password, or I want to have access to their text messages up until a certain age? I mean, what do you think about that?
Sure. So there are two inherent challenges with that. First, rather than age, we want to focus on developmental stage. So when your child is ready for a private Facebook account, let's say, has more to do with their developmental stage, with the maturation that they display to you, than it does with their chronological age, because they're going to have one someday if they want it. The question is whether that's at 18, 25, or 15. And how do we determine whether they're ready for it? Following safety, then we look at those other manifestations of how the device or the account is being used in their life. And then we set our parameters accordingly. So, hey, temporarily, while we get going on this, Johnny, we're going to set it up so that I'm doing a lot of watching over your shoulder to make sure I know who you are, you know, hanging out with virtually online. And then as I have fewer and fewer questions about that, you're going to be self-monitoring it so that you're ready to roll well before you're 18 and leaving the house, because I want you to have some practice at doing that before you go. And when our kids say, well, how come? That's ridiculous. The answer can be as simple as, well, you know, when I had my birthday party, I wanted to feel really celebrated. And so I invited the whole office, or I even threw a block party. But what I did not do, and what I would not do, and what your mom wouldn't do, is throw a party where the guest list is the entire world, and the admission requirement is simply to like me, or like something I've said, or best of all, be my follower. Oh, and also, I'm going to host the party in my bedroom. None of us would do that. We wouldn't expect the same for you. And that's kind of where it's okay to become a little bit more authoritarian, where you say, no, I'm sorry, that's not going to work, because I care too much about you to let your disappointment in me trump my concerns for your safety.
But you don't like because I said so.
I don't like it. Yeah, the because I said so, oh, it's limitedly effective. What does that mean? A lot of people say a lot of things. It for me, it's frivolous. It doesn't really carry a lot of weight. Do I say it sometimes? Of course. None of this is do it my way. It's effective. Its effectiveness is limited because it doesn't communicate much. Instead, how about, because it's the same way I do it, I don't stay up all night either. Or it's the same way your mom does it. She has a great job, but she doesn't, let it dominate her. So there's what we say, there's mm-hmm. what we're modeling for our kids. And then because I said so, it doesn't have to be used very
sure.
often.
Yeah. Dr. Murray, what do you think?
Yeah, I think an important reminder for kids too is they are creating a digital footprint. So for their entire life and beyond, people are going to be able to look and see what they were involved in on social media, employers, future colleges, that job they really, really, really want, somebody they really wanted to date. All of these things are going to be out there forever. And so me as a parent, I'm telling you how to, just like when we go out to dinner and you're polite to people and you have nice manners, well, we got to make sure that in this world, virtual world, you can extend the same manners and understand those interactions, because it's very true that, yeah, maybe that really is Sarah from two schools over, but maybe it's, Joe from around the corner. We don't know. And so you can actually have those conversations very young. Kids 7, 8, 9, they really start to care about what people think about them. They want to be considered good citizens. It's kind of developmentally where they are. It's not care, oh, I hope I'm wearing the right shirt. It's more of they have a sense of society. And so if you can engage in those conversations of we want to see the world respect you because they know you're a good person, and this is how you're going to model that behavior online.
All right, we're talking about the impact of screen time on our kids, and in particular, Dr. Joe Dilley's here talking about his book, The Game is Playing Your Kid, How to Unplug and Reconnect in the Digital Age. Got a chance to learn more tonight, 6 p.m. at the Norman Howard School. There is a free screening of a film called Screenagers, and after that, there will be a panel discussion. Screenagers is growing up in the digital age, and then a panel discussion follows the film covering the impact of screen time for kids. Dr. Dilley will be there for that. That's 6 p.m. at the Norman Howard School tonight. Let's get our only break. We'll come back to your phone call, your phone calls, and I want to ask Dr. Dilley about some of what he has seen in his practice, you know, the way kids are responding to discipline or screen time, and you know what we might characterize as addiction or what they say they need. You know, some of the incidents he describes in his book are, there was a section that scared me a little bit. We're going to talk about that and a lot more with Dr. Dilley. Also here is Dr. Elizabeth Murray, assistant professor in the Department of Pediatrics at Golisano Children's Hospital. That's next. I'm Evan Dawson. Tuesday on The Next Connections, Father Thomas Rosica joins us. He's back in Rochester. He went to St. John Fisher. He now works for the Holy See Press Office at the Vatican. He's a remarkable man, and he is talking about issues facing the Catholic Church, Pope Francis, and more. Second hour, Gary Craig, Democrat and Chronicle reporter, talking about his new book, 7 Million, about the unsolved Brinks heist. Talk to you Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me just briefly remind you that we're in the middle of our spring membership campaign. And I'm just going to try two ways to get you to call 454-6300, and then we're going to get right back to the conversation. First of all, books. Does any host read books anymore? We really value that. We have this book today, The Game is Playing Your Kid by Dr. Joe Dilley. Tomorrow, Gary Craig, reporter for the Democrat and Chronicle, is going to be here talking about his book, 7 Million, about the Rochester Brinks heist. It's a fabulous book. So, there's some pleasure involved for the host. It's nice to read books, and especially books we want to read. But the point is this. How many interviews do you see? And the author's pretty clear that the host didn't read the book. And so tell me, what is this book about? And Joe's probably heard that once in a while, a little bit once in a while.
I appreciate and could tell immediately that you had read. So.
Well, we have Megan Mack and I work very hard to make sure that we don't have authors come in here and they're being blindly interviewed. And so if you value that, please call 454-6300, 454-6300 to make your pledge of support, become a member, because that goes part and parcel with our commitment to a lot of preparation research. So we come in here prepared more than 500 hours a year on this program. So there's that. The other thing is, this little thing about the importance of membership at the time we're in right now. I'm not going to tell you the sky is falling in Washington. We're all watching what's going on there. But the bottom line is, we need you more than ever. If you like what you hear every day, I know you do, you're listening, we need you right now. And the odds are you're not a member. Change that right now, 454-6300, 454-6300, or WXXINews.org. Easy to find the donate button. Please do that now. Okay, let me get back to your phone calls. Tom in Rochester is next on the phone. Go ahead, Tom.
I just wanted to have somebody critique some of the techniques that I've tried and used. One of them is one of your guests just said that everything's traceable. And I looked at my then 14-year-old son. I said, I trust you completely, I think it was a tower back then. I said, but just remember, every keystroke that you do is traceable. And the look on his face was priceless. And I trust him, and he's now a 21-year-old and well-adjusted, I hope. And the other thing is, when they were younger, my twins, I said, in the car, you can't text. And then as they got older, I said, okay, you can text. If you tell me who you're texting, what they're saying, and what you're saying back to them. And they'd say, oh, Dad, that's crazy. But I said, okay, you can't use it. Well, they'd say, oh, this is Jill. I said, oh, tell Jill. I said, hi. Well, you've never met her before. I said, well, tell her anyway. And they'd reluctantly say, Jill says hi, and I'd meet Jill later on, and we'd have that connection. My point was, I said, I don't want to ride in the car alone, and Jill's not here with us. You have to make it social. And I think that was the one way that I tamed the car phone for, or the cell phone in the car. But just wondering if those are decent techniques, or, I mean, I've had some success with it. Trying not to be authoritarian, but I thought it was kind of cute. So
I love it, Tom. You're such a dad, man. I love that. I love that. Thank you, Tom. Thanks for the phone call. What do you think, Dr. Dilley?
It sounds pretty effective to me, Tom. And, you know, at certain ages, kids are going to appropriately say, you know, that's actually a violation of my privacy. Now, that may be. And then the question, of course, becomes, who's paying for the hardware? Who's paying for the internet? Who's paying for the use of the phone? How does that all work? So ideally, you want to set those things up ahead of time so that, you know, if your son or daughter is alleging verbally and then behaving accordingly in such a way that suggests I'm actually ready for private and unmonitored use of a device, okay, well, then they're probably evidencing that based on some other high responsibility type behaviors that might also suggest they can also pay for the device. And so that's kind of one framework to use to approach it. I don't think there's any hard and fast answer about whether your techniques were, you know, good or not, except, you know, the proof being in the pudding. It sounds pretty effective. And so what I endeavor to do at my office, and Dr. Murray, I'll be curious to hear what you think, is try to give families paradigms, frameworks, decision trees to use to help them, you know, guide them through those gray areas.
And I think, too, this is something that, you know, it's new for us as parents. And there's nothing wrong with a kid understanding that their parents are trying to figure out their way, too. You know, I always joke with parents about it's really important to read a really goofy book that you stumble over with your young child, because your child sees you making a mistake and getting over it and recovering and you're fine. And so, you know, our kids need to understand that we're humans and we're in it with them together. And so having a conversation about the right way to get through this is totally appropriate.
Totally.
And yeah, you're not going to win if you just throw down mandates, especially a teenager needs to understand, appropriately so, the rationale behind why you're making those decisions.
Dr. Dilley, you give us a possible example that I wonder if you've seen in practice or at least heard about. And for me, frankly, it was frightening as a parent. In the section on playing defense, you talk about a child who wants to use an iPad. You're setting a limit, and all of a sudden they start to threaten self-harm. They talk about cutting their wrists. They talk about saying, you know, I'd rather kill myself, things like that.
Yep.
Which is obviously, I hope it's obvious, a very serious situation, whether or not they're serious about that. So, first of all, have you heard of those kinds of cases where it gets elevated that seriously?
Unfortunately, yes. I was telling the parents this morning at the Norman Howard School that I wish I were making that scenario up. I'm not making it up, and the reason that it's included in the book is it's important for those rare cases. The parents in those rare cases know that there's still a solution, an option, an alternative to just saying, oh, well, I better give him the iPad. Because, of course, doing that, although it may, you know, preempt something awful, it also reinforces inadvertently that now all I have to do if I want something is just threaten to harm myself or someone else, and mom or dad will eventually fold. So what we have to do instead, and I should add a caveat that every situation is different, and this is not professional psychotherapy right now, that in general, what we need to do is find ways of extinguishing that kind of escalation, that sort of threat. And that can involve getting support from trusted professionals. That includes the ER or calling 911. And then that way, even if your child was just bluffing and it's bluster, they weren't really going to hurt themselves or somebody else, you've still achieved the same goal, which is extinguishing that kind of response. And instead, you're going to reinforce the next time that you ask them to go ahead and turn off the game, and they do so. Now they've just earned perhaps more time tomorrow or later, or better yet, when they turn it off without your prompting or with even less of your prompting, now they earn even more access. Why? Because they're demonstrating they can handle it and they are still the player.
You also talk about sort of kind of trying to teach them a lesson by saying, you know, if we call 911, you're paying for the ambulance trip. And I went, whoa, this is getting really, I mean, we're talking about threatening suicide, whether real or not. I can, you know, tell me why you wrote what you wrote there.
Yeah, the idea there was not to say in the moment, okay, you're paying for the ambulance trip. It's that after the fact, if the child gets the sense that, well, I actually know what happens after this too, I threaten suicide, and then they call the ambulance, and then I get a ride to the hospital, and I get a 3-day vacation. Now they can sock it to us, they can stick it to us by simply threatening self-harm again and saying, go ahead, take me away. And so the idea was, after incident number one, to approach your child and say, by the way, that won't be happening that way again. If you want to play it out that way again, that'll be to the tune of you reimbursing us for it through things that we would have already otherwise allocated the $10,000 for.
But you got to be sure, don't you, that they were bluffing? I mean, my concern is when self-harm, when suicide gets brought up, you got to be very careful, and you want to, if you're going to be punitive, then you got to know that they're bluffing, don't you?
Oh, okay, sorry, I think something's getting lost. Basically, what you're saying is, as a parent, you're saying, I will take measures to protect your safety if that involves taking you to the ER or getting you there by way of an ambulance. If, however, you get there and it was all an act,
okay, yeah.
Then the next time you do another act, whether real or imagined, bluster, you can foot the bill, because we're not going to get into that game either. The idea is that there is always a conclusion, a solution. The symptom will never be the answer. There will always be a rally for health and safety and well-being and balance.
Dr. Murray, what do you think?
Yeah, I actually have seen these exact scenarios play out. And I will say this, that every time it wasn't, you know, a family in Mayberry, and then all of a sudden this happens, these were families in crisis for the most part, that this was the escalation of the day. And so I think you would have to look at the specific situation and see what your family is going through and what your child is going through, and what the mental health history is of the whole family, and what you've been experiencing, and what you bring to the table with your own experiences as a parent and your ability to handle that. Of course, you know, obviously, you know, we have to take any threat like that very, very serious. But there is more and more, I think, a sense of kids feeling that they can do these incredibly dramatic fronts and blusters because they see videos of the same things happening on social media. And so I do feel, and this is anecdotal, but I do feel in my, you know, almost 15 years of being a pediatrician that the threats are getting more dramatic, and the blustering is getting to be more impressive and more dramatic in a much younger age, with the caveat, unfortunately, that we now know in our community here, we are having unbelievable rates of completed suicides, even in very, very young children. So it could be a whole show.
Yeah.
It could be a whole show.
Unfortunately. Before I move on to other parts of the book here, Dr. Dilley, let's put a bow on this, because I know you're not at all minimizing the threat of self-harm.
No, in fact, I feel like I'm maximizing it, that even if it's just turns out to be just a threat, you want to take it, like Dr. Murray said, incredibly seriously. Calling in extra support to keep your child safe is critical for their well-being, and so that if they weren't serious, so that they don't try that same technique again.
All right, so before the hour is gone, we should revisit a point that started to get made earlier, because we put a lot of negative spin on gaming and screen time, but there is, Dr. Murray, you've said it before too, you see some benefit as well here,
sure.
Right?
Oh, there's a bajillion teachable moments in it. You know, I was talking about Pokemon Go once. And
Pokemon Go, yes.
How, you know, that because I'm at my daughter's side and we're doing it together.
Where did it go, by the way? Where did Pokemon Go?
Village Gate still has a lot of Pokemon. Okay. Yes, we learned that at Lento the other night. My daughter was beside herself. I let her try some. But as a game, I think it's faded out a little bit, unless you're 7. So, you know, the point of all of this is, especially for the younger children, start with them being by your side. You know, my daughter says, can I watch a show? Sure. She's 7. She's like, well, are you coming? And I think, yay, that's a parenting win. Because she's expecting me to be right there next to her to watch that show, which is fine, because we can work through those things together. Whether you're watching the very best Sesame Street episode or old He-Man reruns, there's going to be something that you can talk about with your child. And then you can spin it into something that they're feeling and facing in their real life.
Sure. This is one of the red herrings mentioned in
Joe's book, Is Gaming Bad for the Brain? Does it negatively impact intelligence? And the answer is generally no, that a recent international study documented that within gamers, there is increased brain volume in areas that manage important functions like memory and planning. So, you know, there are some benefits here, though
sure.
I do think it's fair to point out that violence in games may have be a sort of a separate category, but you see some benefit here.
Great, great distinction that you just made, Evan. Yes, there is some benefit. It's well documented. And the distinction is, yes, when we're talking about violent content, opposable content, you're going to want to set your own limits within your home about what you and your partner and your kids take in, because as the old statistical adage goes, garbage in, garbage out. And we don't want our kids acting like what they are watching sometimes. And so we have to place limits on the content sometimes more than the time. We also know that time is also important because if limiting time in some instances is important, because if kids are playing 3 or more hours of violent video games a day, that interferes with their development of empathy, social reasoning, kind of the moral compass, as it were. And so there's research to support, you know, limits going the other way as well.
I was not familiar with the Bobo question. I wasn't. So
yes.
Can you kind of tell us a little bit about...
Sure. So decades ago, psychologists put a video or an act in front of preschoolers wherein one child beat up on an inflatable doll called Bobo. And it was one of those... dolls that would, it was inflatable, it would bounce back.
Mm-hmm.
And with no verbal instruction, so modeling only, after watching this modeled for them, the young students became more, statistically significantly, more aggressive with one another. And so the Bobo question is, do I want my kid acting like what he's watching? And if the answer is no, then it's perfectly acceptable and healthy to help find limitations on that.
Okay, so... as much as over the years you could find a ton of headlines, do violent video games impact kids? Is this pretty settled to you that there can be a deleterious impact on this?
Sure.
Violence,
yeah? Yep.
Dr. Murray,
yeah,
same?
I agree.
Okay. So apart from the violence then, you know, the message is not no screen time. The message
right.
is not no benefit to games, et cetera, here.
Right.
So in our closing minutes here, let's help people sort of set a structure. If you're helping people sort of set their new structure, it's kind of regaining the hierarchy within yeah. the household, which should not be dominated by games or screen time.
That's right.
How do you take those steps?
You bet. So one of the students at Norman Howard this morning really put it well. You know, I give a little and then I get a little. And I said, are you satisfied with this arrangement? And he said, yeah. And I said, how about your parents? Yeah. That's it. So just like what we do in our adult world, you know, we eat sort of nutritiously and we exercise and yeah, we look a little better and we keep doing it. And
we stop and get a croissant on the way to work.
Yeah. And then we, right. We reward ourselves
run to
with
eat,
a little.
Man. That's right.
Perfect. Yeah. Well, we do. We reward ourselves with a little break. That's what we want to help our kids to do now so that they know how to do it when they get closer to adulthood. And that entails typically some kind of agreement or rider. And then, you know, sometimes we don't want to have to just enforce. And so we let technology be our ally. And that turns out to be a resource that we use to help manage technology. So I consult with Disney on their Circle device. I consult with Screen Limit from the UK on their device, on their app called Screen Limit. And these are wonderful ways of kind of taking some of the moment-to-moment negotiation out and allow tech to do the implementation for us.
Okay. Dr. Murray, some final thoughts from you on you know, how parents can sort of reconstruct that hierarchy at home?
I think that if you're doing it with your child, that's at the end of the day, that's what they would like. Parents, unfortunately, are spending more and more time out of the household. And so the actual family time is getting to be less and less. And so playing the game or interacting on social media with their friends is going to be important for peer development. But having that time with you to do it and play the game with you is going to be so important, because you all understand what they're doing, and then they're going to actually be with you and you can talk about whatever might happen to come up while you're being beaten in Super Mario Kart by your 5-year-old.
You're a cool parent. You do all that stuff for them, don't you?
I do. You got to do it. You got to do it. It's fun.
And so I mentioned to Joe that I had not known about the Bobo thing. I also did not know the term Screenagers, which is the name of the film that is showing tonight at the Norman Howard School, 6 p.m. If you want to check that out, it's Screenagers, Growing Up in the Digital Age. That's a 6 p.m. screening, and then a panel discussion will follow the film. Dr. Dilley will be there for that. Is Screenagers a thing? Is that a term, or is that that's new to me? Liz, you know everything on that.
I've certainly heard of it.
I've not.
Screenagers.
Until your book came and this discussion, I had not heard that. How often do you hear that?
This is a pretty recent one for me as well, but I get the idea. I think it's a nice... It really captures the issue.
Okay, and so let me close by asking you about the progress you've seen. You wrote a book to offer families some structural help. You've seen a lot in your own practice, but apart from the stories that are concerning about some of these extreme cases, have you also seen people come back to you and say, "Look, this is working. We've made a change." Kids can be pretty obstinate about what they want.
Sure.
What have you seen in terms of progress?
Certainly. I just presented at a school in Pasadena last week, and I had a mom of a former client of mine come up and say, "Yep, he's still doing great. Of course, we'll double check tonight." And it was like, yeah, there it is. He's doing better because you're doing the monitoring that you need, or now the less monitoring that you need to do, but you're still going to keep tabs on him. He's a high school kid, really smart, but he was underperforming a couple years ago when they came to me. The approach works because it's rooted in decades-old, tried-and-true psychological approaches where we maximize autonomy and agency, and we reinforce kids accordingly, and we respect their developmental stage and age. So I have kids in the office find the book in the waiting room and go, "Ay, ay, yeah." And then they flip through it, and I kid you not, I had a kid raise it up above his head and tell his mom a few weeks ago, "Mom, you need to read this. It's fair." And that's what we're going for, is something that works for kids and parents too.
I mean, did you pay him to do that?
Well, yeah, I mean, there was a little bit of that arrangement on the side, but...
Fair is a, you know what, that's a pretty good endorsement for the book.
From a teen, I'll take it. Bet.
Dr. Joe Dilley's book that he's talking about, the book that teenager, right, by the way, how old?
14.
It's a pretty good endorsement, said was fair. The book is The Game is Playing Your Kid, How to Unplug and Reconnect in the Digital Age. You can get it tonight. Dr. Dilley will be there at the Norman Howard School at 6 p.m. Great having you here. Thank you for taking the time to come in.
Thank you.
Safe travels back to L.A. Dr. Murray, safe travels about another 2 or 3 miles, wherever you're going today. Nice having you, as always.
Thank you. Pleasure to be back.
And our thanks to Mike Black, who has engineered today's broadcast, and Megan Mack is the producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Hope you have a nice afternoon, and we'll talk to you Tuesday on Member Supported. Did you hear that? Member Supported. Public Radio.